Our guest now is Kevin Anderson, renowned British climate scientist. He was former director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. We welcome you back on Context TV. Welcome.
It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you. We heard again big speeches here at the COP, and it seems that the world leaders really want to save the planet last minute. Reality looks a bit different. Tell us about the reality.
Well, first, I'm not so easily convinced by the world leaders. I mean, there are some notable exceptions. I think the Prime Minister of Barbados has been a really good example of a leader that seemed to understand the severity of the challenges and have the integrity to talk to those challenges. I think many of the other leaders actually are not taking climate change seriously and are not putting in the policies that are necessary to deliver anything like the commitments that those same leaders have signed up to. So in terms of the reality of the situation we're in today, if we are to meet our Paris Agreement, staying well below 2 degrees centigrade and ideally only 1.5, remembering that that was strengthened during the G7 agreement in May of this year, so really we should be focusing on 1.5 degrees centigrade, then we have just very few years to reduce our emissions. For the wealthy parts of the world, for 1.5, we really need to be zero emissions from our energy, so from our industry, from our homes, from our flying, from our ships, from our cars, from everything from use of energy in our countries, by about 2030 to 2035 at the very outside, if we are to stay within even an outside chance of 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming. The poorer countries have a little bit longer, which is in line with the commitments that we made, what's called common but differentiated responsibility, the equity component of our agreements. So they have a little bit longer, but only by about 10, at the most 15 years, to reduce their emissions to zero. But we are not hearing any commitments here that are anywhere near in line with what the science requires. Instead, we are hearing repeated high-level net zero commitments that are almost meaningless in relation to our climate change challenge.
The Guardian reported that if all promises given in Glasgow are kept, we would keep temperature under 2 degrees Celsius. There's another number, 2.7 degrees, that came out of a study, I guess it was the UN. If all states kept their promises, that was before Glasgow. That seems like progress compared to Paris and quite not so dim a future anymore. What do you make of all of these numbers?
Well, first, remember that the problem is not the same that we have today as it was in 2015 in Paris. The 6 years in between mean that we've emitted about 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide every single year. So we are talking about a huge amount of carbon dioxide that's been emitted since Paris. So the challenge is much more difficult. And we've now said we want to focus more on the 1.5 degree centigrade commitment. What the Guardian is reporting on, this 1.8 or 1.9, depending which study you read, I think is highly misleading. First, it assumes that when a government says net zero, they mean zero, but they do not. When they say net zero, they mean they're going to use some sort of technology in the future that does not exist today to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to compensate for their ongoing increase or ongoing levels of emissions from more cars or the same number of cars, but not reducing them, from flying, from not changing our housing stock in our cities. So looking at all of the sorts of places that we emit carbon dioxide today, they're not looking at reducing that anywhere near the level that's necessary, and they're going to compensate that, or not they, our children and our children's children are going to compensate for that by having to develop technologies to remove our carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in 2050, 2060, and 2070 and beyond. So it's only if you believe that that is a reasonable thing to do you get anywhere near the 1.8 and 1.9. If you actually think that is not an appropriate thing to do, then you take us much more again towards the 3 degrees centigrade of warming, if not higher.
Reports by the Global Carbon Project and the Washington Post show a huge gap between what is reported in emissions here at the UN by the states and what is actually emitted. What does that mean and leave us with?
If they're right, and there is this huge gap, that is a major problem, because we always have to remind ourselves that the physics and the science of climate change does not care about our various accountancy scams. It only cares about the absolute amount of emissions. So if countries are deliberately misreporting, or even if they're just doing it accidentally, if they're misreporting their data, then the climate will still warm by as much as the actual real emissions are. And it means that we're not putting policies in place informed by what the data really tells us. And so we have to ensure that the data we have is reliable and accurate. And it's particularly concerning if this is being done deliberately. So I'm hoping that actually if there are problems in the way these things are accounted, that recognizing that problem is that we can quickly rectify that and put it right. We need accurate accounts to really understand the challenges that we face.
You have published a study where you show that even so-called ambitious countries like Sweden and the UK are far behind for what is needed to keep temperature even below 2 degrees Celsius. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, in that study, what we did, we took the Paris Agreement and we downscaled that using the science from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, what we call their carbon budgets, the total amount of carbon dioxide we can emit. So we downscaled those carbon budgets to the wealthier, the developed and the developing countries. And then we downscaled them again to say, what does that mean for the UK and Sweden? As two examples of wealthy countries that have quite clear climate change targets. And then we estimated the emissions under the commitments that the governments have made and compared that with our estimate as what was necessary for Paris. And there was a huge gap between those two. And so what we looked at was saying that if you followed the government position in the UK and Sweden, it was more in line with 2.5 to 3 degrees centigrade of warming than 1.5 to 2 degrees. And the reason for that is first that they completely ignore equity. So the wealthy countries such as the UK and Sweden are really assuming that the reductions they make are really no different for those, the rate of reductions, from that of the poorer countries of the world. Now, that is not in line with our equity commitments that we sign up to every year. So that's firstly wrong. The second thing is that they are highly reliant on these future technologies that do not yet exist or are in very small pilot schemes to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in years to come. So the combination of those two, that equity part and the reliance on the future technology, has meant that their national commitments are underplaying the severity of their real emissions. And that means that if you played out the real futures that these governments are expecting, then that's much more in line with 2.5 to 3 degrees centigrade of warming.
You also counted in your study a global overhead, cement production and deforestation. That is very special. I haven't seen that in other studies. Why have you done that?
Yeah, there were two significant reasons. Our focus was on energy, and there are many low carbon or zero carbon forms of energy available, and they're available to wealthy and richer countries. They're well understood. We have some of them already. Our concern about cement is about 8% of global emissions. About half of that, 4%, is actually from the energy used in producing the cement. Now, we could do that low carbon. But the other 4%, which is a very significant part, is the chemical process in making cement. And that is much more challenging to actually deal with. We can deal with it, it's going to take us quite a long time. And our concern was that the wealthy parts of the world, we don't use that much cement anymore. So our cement use, because we have our buildings, we have our infrastructure, we've built our power stations and our roads and our train lines. So we still use some cement, but not a lot. If you look at the poorer countries as they're developing, they're building their water systems, their sewage systems. They're putting in place their train lines, their buses, they're building their buildings. And so they're using lots more cement than we are, I mean, many, many times more. And so it would be very unfair to penalise those countries, which would affect their development, by putting cement as something that they have to factor into their emissions in a way that that unfairly penalised their overall carbon budget. And so we felt it was appropriate, it was a global overhead. Not that we ignore it, but that we reduce it in the wealthy parts of the world, but we also help the poorer parts of the world as quickly as possible move to low carbon cement. And that probably will mean there are certain things you can do technically to do that, but also what we call carbon capture and storage, which I'm not in favour of for energy, but I think on cement and steel could be a really beneficial technology. And that's why we took cement out, for the equity reasons. And it's the same sort of arguments that we made for deforestation. The wealthy parts of the world, such as the UK, we're at 13% of our land cover is forest. So we've already deforested, and it gives us lots of land for agriculture and other things. And then we're penalising other countries for doing what we have already done. Now, we don't want the other countries to deforest, but it's not just their responsibility, it is also our responsibility. So again, it should be a global overhead where we all take some responsibility for deforestation.
You have been criticizing your colleagues for not speaking truth to power. Why is that?
I'm particularly critical of some, not all, some of the senior academics and other ones as well, but mostly the senior academics.
But you don't want to name them?
Not yet. No, I don't want to name them. But they, and often it's because they're doing this for well-meaning reasons, but to me it's really misguided. So in private, they will tell me things from their work about how bad the situation is. And then in public, they will say something that is much more hopeful, that is not supported by their evidence. And sometimes the difference between those two is huge. They will also promote technologies which they don't think will work at the scale that they have in their models, but they put them in the models because it gives them an output that means they don't have to significantly question the current political economic framework or paradigm. And the reason that some of them make is that we can't change the paradigm, and therefore we have to sort of change our assumptions or massage the language we use to make it look more appealing. Now, that might be appropriate if you're an NGO, if you're a spin doctor of a political party. To me, that is completely inappropriate for academics. Our job, and it's quite a simple remit, is to do our job, care, our work, our research carefully, recognize we get things wrong occasionally and change them when we do, but then communicate it clearly and bluntly to whoever wants to listen. We should not be there to spin a cheery story. We should not be there to make it attractive to the NGOs or the policymakers. It's only the content of our message as academics that really matters. But I think we have been very dangerous. We have been spinning a tale which fits with the political dialogue for far too long on this issue. And as time has passed and the challenge has got harder and harder, we have spun an increasingly imaginary tale rather than saying what our science is telling us. And I hear this repeatedly. This is just occasionally. As an example of this, I was at an event recently when the person, when she was speaking, was saying, you know, things are challenging, but there are things that we can do, and she was explaining that. And then afterwards on the train, she put her head in her hands and excuse the language. She just said, we're fucked. We're absolutely fucked. Now, I don't think she should have used that language in the seminar, but I think she should have expressed that feeling through her research in the seminar. She shouldn't wait and say that privately to me on the train. And if we misinform the policymakers, if we misinform the public, how can they develop policies that are in line with the information?
Where are we heading actually right now, temperature-wise, and what impacts would that have on the world and on us?
I think it's hard to say exactly where we're heading, but to my assessment, somewhere between 3 to 4 degrees centigrade of warming across this century. So I've used this language before, that is like living on a different planet. If we look at the recent report that came out from the IPCC, SR 1.5, when they looked specifically at the climate impacts for 1.5 degrees centigrade and compared them with the climate impacts for 2 degrees centigrade, but at 1.5, as an example, you kill about 3/4 of the barrier reef and other tropical corals. At 2 degrees, you kill all of those. And so even at these lower temperatures and just small differences, we see huge impacts on major ecosystems. Now, imagine that playing out now for our insect communities that pollinate our crops, that produce our food, that help us produce the food. We're going to severely impact that, and we're already seeing that in some places. And so what we're going to have from that will be lots of issues to do with food production. But exacerbating that, making that worse, will be droughts and floods. Military tension, as we see in some parts of the world, mean again there'll be less stability to help people, you know, with their industries and with their agriculture. So we see basically what we're seeing at 3 to 4 degrees centigrade of warming is the collapse of many of our current ecosystems. They will eventually evolve into new ones over very long periods, but also the collapse of many of our human systems because they will not be able to deal with that rate of change. So 3 or 4 degrees centigrade in a million years doesn't really matter. 3 or 4 centigrade in several thousand years is less of an issue. 3 or 4 centigrade in 100 years is a disaster. And so I think we have to recognize that our systems, our human and our ecological systems, will not be able to respond in a reasonable fashion at that rate of change.
There's a lot of greenwashing going on at the COP. Not only the governments give nice talks, but also corporations like financial institutions. Where's the money really going and where not?
Well, first, actually, there isn't that much money. mean, if we are going to decarbonize, particularly my focus on energy, our energy system, that is a huge challenge, way above the investments that people are talking about. I think people still think that responding to climate change is a bolt-on to business as usual. It's not. It's a completely fundamental shift. So it is. I often use the example of, I've used this before, like the reconstruction of Europe after the Second World War, or Roosevelt's New Deal. But it's even more than that. You know, every facet of our built infrastructure, from our transport to our houses to our industry to our electrification of the energy system, all of that has to happen within 1-2, at the very outside, 3 decades. So we're not talking about investments that are that large. What we're talking about, investments that are still quite big, but they're not actually investments always in the technologies. A lot of this financial structure is about ways we can use finance to try to drive certain technologies. But in reality, I think these are much more financial mechanisms and instruments that what they do in the end, like banking often does, it makes money for the people who organize the banking instruments. It doesn't actually deliver on the changes that are necessary. So the same people that developed the same sorts of mechanisms that led us to the banking crisis in 2007, 2008, those same people are developing the same sort of complex financial mechanisms to try and address climate change. What we need, if we're going to use any finance here, it needs to be transparent and honest. And I think my fear is with the way that we're looking at the finance, it's not going to be the transparent or honest. And it's going to feed into the idea that we can do something by always paying for someone else to make the change elsewhere.
You have participated in a study that tries to figure out why real action is blocked over 3 decades, 4 decades, 5 decades in regards to the climate crisis so far. What are the results and what can we learn from that?
Well, that was a really interesting piece of work. It was very challenging. There were 23 authors, I think, and we tried to understand through different levels of expertise, what we call them lenses. So some people looked at psychology, some people looked at technical issues, other people looked at issues of governance. So we looked at 9 different ways as to why it is, reasons as to why it is we may not have bent the emissions, well, we haven't bent the emissions curve in the right direction. And our conclusion from this was fairly clear for all of these, that power was absolutely at the center of this. There's a power structure which is dominated by a relatively small group of people, which we called, in the paper, we called it the Davos cluster. And that this cluster, which actually is not that many people involved with it, but it does include the sort of what we might call the global mobile elites, the heads of our companies, the heads of our governments, the heads of our financial institutions, and indeed supported by some academics as well. And that this particular group held a lot of power in our society, but they were not a particularly large group. But their interest in holding that power was to maintain the power. It was not to respond to the challenges that we face, whether they're ecological challenges or some of the social challenges. And our judgment was that they were completely ill-equipped. These people could not change to help us address climate change, yet they talk as if they can. So then we start to say, well, where would the power come from? And what we were quite intrigued by there was it looks like there is a lot of discussion at the sort of grassroots, bottom-up level that is much more in line with what the science is calling for. And also, it's many more people are there. I mean, most of the population are not in Davos. That's a small percentage of the population. So if the rest of us actually start to mobilize the power we actually have and engage also, we felt, much more with the research, the academic community, we could provide a different power structure, which was much more open to a wider group of people to be involved, rather than this very elite, top-down form of power. This is not to say that leaders aren't important. They are. But it's a much more relationship between bottom-up and top down. And at the moment, we're dominated by this top down, and they have failed and they are ill-equipped and unable to respond to the climate challenge. They're locked into a mindset and a model that is complete, but it's caused the problem. It's not going to help us solve the problem. And so we needed much more of this sort of bottom-up leadership to help us break this impasse that we have today.
What is needed in policy action to keep us away from catastrophic climate heating is 2 degrees Celsius. Technical and economically feasible anymore? If yes, how great is the challenge?
Well, it's interesting you use the word economical there. Is it economically feasible? I think failing on 2 degrees centigrade is not economically feasible. So I almost would say, well, let's take the economics, or certainly let's take the finance out of it, because we have to do something about this, because in any economic or financial measure, not doing something about this is chaotic. And so we have to do something. I don't think, and I may be wrong on this, I don't think we have very much chance at all of staying at 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming. I hope to be proved wrong, and I'm really pleased that civil society groups are pushing hard for that. I think we just about can stay below 2 degrees centigrade of warming, not just technically, but I think there are policies we know what we need to do. We know technically and the policy landscape of what is necessary, but we haven't got the courage to put those things in place. So if we are to put them in place, what is really important is not what happens in 2030, 2040, 2050, what happens between now and 2030. You know, 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide every single year. That's what we're putting out in the atmosphere. For a good chance of 1.5, we only have 320 billion tons we can put out. So it doesn't take much of a calculation to tell you that's just a handful of years. And so what we do when we come straight out of the COP on Saturday and Sunday and the week after and the month after, that is the really key period of time. Not what we do in 2035 or 2040. And that comes really clearly from the science. And so if we are serious about our agenda, we have to start thinking, well, where are the emissions coming from today that we can change? And to start off, much of that is going to come from regulations that will change the behaviour of those of us who are responsible for most of the emissions. And I think that's really important for your listeners to really understand, is that there's repeated evidence that demonstrates good academic research that half of all global emissions just come from 10% of the population. That the top 1% of emitters have a carbon footprint that is twice as big as the bottom 50% of the global population. And how many of those 1% are here? I mean, some of the ones that are in the 0.01%, the Obamas and the Bidens and the Johnsons, that they fly in here, and the DiCaprios and all these other great and good, usually men, they fly in here and tell us about what to do about climate change. They and their outlook and the model that has allowed them to live these very resource profligate lifestyles is the problem. And so we have to recognise that unless we're going to make profound changes to the lifestyles of those of us who are in that top 10% and in the top 1%, and that includes people like myself and many of us here, we are going to fail on climate change. So we know that, though. So let's make policies that reduce our emissions. Let's drive our emissions down. At the same time, we need structural change in our society in terms of our houses, our transport, our wider infrastructure. We need to electrify much of our energy system. Only 20% of our energy is actually electricity. The other 80% typically is fossil fuels directly. So we need to electrify almost all of that. That is a massive structural challenge, a wonderful jobs agenda. So we need to separate out this idea that there's a single public, there's a single we. There isn't. There are multiple we's and multiple publics. And the way we respond to this is different for those. So for the majority of people in even, you know, typical Western countries, they are average or below average emitters. And for them, it's much more about structural change to their homes, to their transport, how they get to work, where their work is sited, all those sorts of structural issues. But for those of us responsible for most of emissions, it's big changes in our lifestyles. And we will not do that voluntarily. It means we will have to be required by regulation to do it. And however we may sweeten that pill, it's effectively for us, we will see that in the short term as a sacrifice. But that sacrifice is, what is it for? It's for the poor people around the world that are already being impacted by climate change, sometimes dying even now. It's for our own children's future, for their children's future, and for the future of other species as well. So that sacrifice is worth paying, in my view, because of the wonderful benefits that we then would have across wider society, and both human and non-human.
What gives you hope, Kevin Anderson?
3 years ago, I was really struggling to answer that question. And what gives me hope now, strangely, is actually it's the civil society movements. The youth movements and the complete range of civil society movements, not just the marches, which are big demonstrations we get to see that the press report on, but all the work that goes on behind that, trying to unpick the policies, trying to look at the numbers, trying to provide an alternative picture. There are huge numbers of people doing this now, involved in this, and also wider groups of society just talking about these issues. There's far more people in those groups than ever in the small elite in the Davos cluster. And my hope is that this lot are having their voices heard and they are starting to change the agenda and the dialogue. And we've already seen that in some of our local politics, where it hasn't gone far enough, but some of our mayors and local councils are pushing an agenda which is far more stringent than our national governments are requiring. It's not enough, but that civil society engagement is absolutely key and gives me some sense of hope.
Thanks a lot for the interview.
It's my pleasure.